Well, I'm going to go ahead and open up in prayer, and we'll get started. Father, thank you for a very glorious day before us. Thank you for the sunshine and the harbingers of spring before us. It's great to finally see. We pray to you bless our morning. Father, as we continue to look into the world around us, we do ask that you would help us to see the things that we need to see and understand, that we would be more faithful witnesses, Father, of your great truth to a world in desperate need. And this we would pray and ask through Jesus. Amen. So, all right. So you have a handout, and I'm hoping it will be actually helpful to you. We're going back into part of Hunter's material. So some of this is directly from him, and others is a kind of a synopsis of that. And starting with one of the things that Hunter has pointed out is that the difficulty for all Christian believers is that this call to faithfulness really is a call to live in fellowship and integrity with the person and the witness of Jesus Christ, or we could say the person and the work of Jesus Christ. And, of course, that's the challenge before us. How do we live in faithfulness in the world around us? And we've noted some of these things, but again, just pointing them out, in our own culture, what we've seen is what he refers to as a bundle of contradictions. You know, we have great energy on one hand and exhaustion on another. We have capitalism that's robust and moving, and then we also have a consumer mentality that is really almost a parasite on us in many ways. We see that democracy empowers, it gives great tools for self-governance, but we also are living in a time when it has moved not only just in the political sphere, it has moved out into other areas of ethics and aesthetics, and it flattens out all ethical distinctions. Another way of saying that is that democracy, at least how it's being experienced by us, tends to have the lowest common denominator bar, where everything just gets shifted to the absolute minimum. We also have seen great technological advances and improved quality of life, and these technological advances bring new forms of violence and oppression. And we've experienced that too. So our society is indeed a bundle of contradictions. It probably is in all societies at all times and places, but these particularly are really felt by us. We understand that. And in our political culture, we also know that we are very fragmented and polarized. That also is not any great revelation. We are polarized beyond belief. Americans as a whole are committed and hopeful, typically. That's kind of an upbeat personality as Americans. And yet we are very distrustful of major institutions and leaders, and we're uncertain about the future. So, you know, if you did a polling of average person out there, most, you know, have a very upbeat way of looking at life. And they're also concerned about a lot of unknown things. We're in a time where we are feeling this disintegration and fragmentation. We're not really sure what it's going to look like. And that's the world we find ourselves in. The three areas that Hunter has been dealing with in terms of politics, he's talked about conservative, progressive, and what he refers to as neo-Anabaptists, so sort of the three large groups that sort of reflect most of American Christians. And for conservatives, the main challenge is seen as secularization. What we see out there is a world that is becoming secular, and God is being removed from the conversation. So what needs to take place is we need to bring God back. And so that tends to be a conservative emphasis politically. On a progressive side, progressive Christians, they often see the main challenge as inequality. They look around there and they say there are a lot of people who are not experiencing the same access to the American dream as others in multitudes of ways. There's inequality, and often the solution has been seen as how do we redistribute wealth and power so that those who are on the fringe or those who are vulnerable have equal access or opportunity. In the Neo-Baptist tradition, Neo-Anabaptist, they see the main challenge in terms of violence and coercion. Our democracy has created that. Our capitalism has created this globalism of consumeristic mentality, and it's produced violence and coercion. And so the solution is in some form of a peace-loving, koinonia is just a great word for Greek word for fellowship, peace-loving koinonia for a church-based community. And Hunter has pointed out that all three are partially correct about the challenges as well as the solution. Where he sees them as mistaken is that everybody sees their challenge as the defining challenge. And you see the quote here, there is not one single challenge. The multiplicity of challenges and the dizzying complexity of their causes are largely what makes the modern world so confounding. And we recognize that, depending on where you are, sort of on the political spectrum, or sort of which group you more identify with, there's this idea that this is the main problem. And it gets recirculated in whatever group you're in, because that's what you talk about. And this is the thing. He's saying, no, it's greater than that. And because of all the vast array of complexities, it's very confounding. Because when you start kind of leaning into the challenge and the solution of your group, it becomes evident, well, that doesn't seem to be covering everything. It's not going to solve all the problems that we think we're experiencing. And that's a huge, huge difficulty. The next section, then, he speaks about what he refers to as difference and dissolution. And we're going to spend more time on that today. And difference is, in a pluralistic society, which is where we live, there is the existence of different beliefs that pose a challenge to Christian beliefs. There's no longer a dominant culture. And that, by definition, is what pluralism does. You get lots of people from lots of contexts, lots of cultures, they come together, and you have to figure out, how do we all live in harmony to some degree with differences? Particularly when you have been moved from maybe a position of a dominant place to now one of equal footing or even a subordinate place. So difference is something that we are struggling with as Christians. It's there, it's real, but what do we do with it? And what we find is this is where the heart of the culture war seemed to take place. There's this collision and conflict of competing cultures. So democracy has provided a legal and political framework for managing these differences up till now. And now they are less adequate. And as we go forward, debate is only going to increase. It's less adequate because there's not sort of a agreed upon view of life that makes democracy more tenable. As I said, when you have greater agreement, your laws are less. There's just a greater social cohesiveness. We have a greater agreement, and we don't have to have laws for everything. As that diminishes, we increase laws. And we become a very litigious, not just in terms of suing one another, but in terms of creating laws, because that has been the challenge. The framework isn't holding like it used to. Some of you may be aware of Peter Berger. He was actually an Austrian-born American sociologist. He died in 2017, and considered a Protestant theologian. One of his books, fairly influential, he's written a lot, The Many Altars of Modernity Towards a Paradigm for Religion in a Pluralistic Age. So he has spent a lot of time analyzing some of this, particularly through the 70s and 80s. And he has a word that gets co-opted by everybody in the field, and he talks about plausibility structures. And that just simply means why and how individuals regard their beliefs as real or true. The credibility of our beliefs depend on certain social conditions that reinforce those beliefs. There's languages, there's symbols, there's social practices. So that creates plausibility structures for why we believe what we believe. And when things are working well, those are self-reinforcing. How do we believe? What do we think? Well, our beliefs, our languages, our symbols all help us in our belief system. There are very few people who are what he refers to as belief virtuosos. Very few people who need little support. That's rare. You know, people who just, this is what I believe, this is what I'm going to do. They got the willpower, the tenacity, the mindset, then they just go out and Boom, I'm a this, and I don't care if people around me aren't. I can do it on my own. Most all of us need reinforcement from the social institutions around us. That provides a way of looking at the world that helps us. Well, pluralism creates social conditions where God is no longer an inevitability. And we notice that. I was watching on a... Oh, it's from the 1950s. There was I don't know if they would even call it a documentary at the time, on Kalispell in the 1950s, early 60s. And they actually showed the Trinity Lutheran Church here and other people, and they showed different churches, and they talked about the importance of church in community. And they did the Kalispell Dairy. They did all the different things at the time. And they made a big deal about the importance of the churches in our community. And that was true. You even see it in the crash scenes on, you know, public squares. We always had nativity scenes and that sort of thing in the public arena. And suddenly someone's come along saying, you got to get rid of it. And that's a huge symbol. And now that those things are being removed, it's not supporting our belief system. It makes it more difficult. Our most important symbols are not pointing to God in the way that they were as a society. He's less obvious than he once was. And we recognize that. So being faithful requires much more of us than it has ever done before. What used to reinforce our faith has gone into the background of sort of a shared public life. And that's a part of the culture war we feel. We talk less about God outside of our religious community. And we recognize that. So, and you all have felt this as well, and I've mentioned this before, the past generation, you at least went to church twice a week. If it was Sunday morning, either Sunday night or Wednesday as a midweek study, everybody went. Well, now, the majority of people who are like regular attenders kind of come to Sunday morning three times a month. And rarely to get anything else.
Or once Saturday night.
Yeah. And, I want to go Saturday night so I can sleep in the morning. So that would have been unthinkable a while back. In the Catholic Church, we did that, and that was in our little arena. That was, it worked. But in the broader Protestant world, nobody was doing that. So when you want to go to church or you want to do those things, you no longer have, as it were, an environment that helps you to do those things. And it makes it harder, and we feel that. And, you know, we all can berate one another and make everybody feel guilty about our lack of participation, but it doesn't change much. So there's a lot of guilt, but not necessarily a lot of things to help that. And because a lot of those things that would just naturally do that have been removed. And so We struggle, and one of the struggles, and he points this out, and it's on your sheet, but it's the problem of syncretism. When you start interacting with other people, typically your hard edges are softened, and there's often accommodation made. And you've probably recognized that even as, not just in a religious arena, but when you talk with people and friends of different persuasions on certain issues, as you interact with them, over time, you probably soften some of your hard edges. And you usually take a step towards somebody. That's also kind of a part of American culture. We have a culture of compromise. And that's not all bad. But in terms of beliefs, there's a huge pressure towards assimilation, to try not to be too different. And there's a challenge in a pluralism on many levels. The challenges of first is our collective identity of a tradition of belief itself is challenged. Christian leaders are seen as a danger by many in a new social order. So rather than in the 1950s, oh, we're so glad we got our churches and they're a vital part of our community, it's now you guys are part of the problem. Your religious stuff, you know, and again, it doesn't have to be based in truth. We already talked about that. There's a sense of just an idea of feeling a sentiment against religion. Religion causes all these wars. And you're like, well, the greatest wars had nothing to do with religion, but that's, you know, again, it doesn't, facts don't matter. So there's this idea that you Christians are a part of the problem. And pluralism then changes our public identity in how we understand ourselves and how we are perceived by others. When you are seen as a part of the good of the commonwealth of people, you have a particular way of engaging the world around you based on that. When people start pressuring you as part of, oh, you're the bigoted haters that don't like people. Well, wait a minute, I'm not a hater. There's a tremendous amount of pressure that comes. It is not an accident that, you know, you just take the issue of sexuality, that for this many thousands of years, the church has stood by a Judeo-Christian ethic of this is human sexuality, and in the last 15 years, you got all these people, well, I've read my Bible and prayed about it, and I've changed my mind. It's interesting that you didn't change your mind against culture. You changed your mind in the direction of culture because it makes your life easier. You don't want to be that person who pushes against all these things. And that's that way in every generation. That's that way when the culture is pushing in wrong directions and suddenly, you know, the church can come alongside of those wrong tendencies. And that's a challenge. So pluralism has created a challenge in how we identify ourselves. It also changes the content of our beliefs and our practices. We have to try to resist assimilation. And a lot of core doctrines have changed because of this pressure to assimilate or not be seen as outside of what's, you know, culturally acceptable. That's a challenge. And pluralism also undermines the possibility of belief and the character of belief. That's how a person believes. There's very little that we can take for granted about faith anymore because the structures are weaker. So our whole identity of belief is questioned, and so most people just deal with a certain amount of doubt and uncertainty in areas of faith that they might not have years ago. So true faith often is marked by people who are wrestling with both their tradition, what they believe, along with their doubts in a far greater way than they ever have. And that's a part of it. I'm not saying we're not getting rid of, well, first hear me, I'm not saying the problem is we need to get rid of pluralism. Well, first, we're not. That's not going to happen. There are good things that come with pluralism, but there are bad things. And it is causing us to deal with real challenges that are before us. And besides the differences, which we've talked about, there's also the challenge of what he refers to as dissolution. In a pluralistic society, the existence of many different beliefs pose a challenge to Christian beliefs. There's no longer, again, this dominant culture. So in this dissolution, which Hunter identifies as the waning of the belief that words and concepts have ultimate meaning. And I'll just look at this last paragraph together and we'll talk about that. So dissolution, of course, means, you know, in a sense, to dissolve. It's the deconstruction of the most basic assumptions of reality. That should have been on your thing, and it wasn't. So, oh, okay, good. So what that means is that it both comes from high culture and middle-low culture. On the high culture end, we have a deconstructivist theory and skepticism that doubts the existence of truth. That's at the high end. On the other end, the pluralism, especially the media environment of modern America, has created an environment that trivializes information and makes depth and reflection more difficult and helps to dissolve meaning. So this idea is that it has dissolved how we understand truth. We are a deconstructive world. And that's, at its best, this is what postmodern philosophy does. It deconstructs. There's a value to it. It's not all bad. You might say postmodernism, when done right, is a good colonic. It detoxifies. It takes things out. It helps you to, okay, we're going to take it all out and start over. We're going to look at all this and we're going to evaluate. We're going to find, you know, all the individual pieces and call into question things that may need to be called into question. The problem is it's not really good in its expression today of building anything positive. So in the ancient world, truth was answerability to the meanings of words. There is a real connection between our words and the world around us. That has always existed. So what we said, words had a particular meaning in a particular place, and that was true. We may not have all the answers, but there was a way to get answers, and the world corresponded to that. In the modern world, questions actually negate the trust that connects human discourse and the reality of the world. It gets pulled apart. So in its most aggressive form, it can foster doubt that what is said has anything to do with what exists out there. And that's where you get, you know, words have no meaning sort of thing. When the object of something and the shared meaning is now undermined, there's no longer confidence that the words signify what we thought they did. And things get used differently. If words can mean anything, that is, it means what we say it means at the time we say it or who we are, there's no fixed point of reference. There's no authority that can be appealed to definitively establish the meaning of ideas or words that will judge between them. Something's not more truthful than another, because there's nothing outside of who we are as individuals and our own ideas that are the arbitrator of meaning. So that's in its worst form. And it's not just for religion. God, nature, science, democracy, tradition, none of these have authority because none of them can be trusted. All of them fall under the same colonic. Everybody has to take the same prune juice. And it doesn't matter who you are, what your belief system, someone, you start pointing holes here, and then they go, oh, well, Mr. Point Holes, let me point holes in you. And then you have to, and everybody discourse takes everything apart. And there's no now reference for words that actually have meaning outside of what it is that somebody means for it. So it's a subjective cul-de-sac. And we see that. Yeah, Jim. It certainly can in its greatest form. What it typically does is it creates, you get a lot of skepticism, irony, and satire. And there's a cynical view of life. And so dialogue is really just shared cynicism. And so when you try to say, well, wait a minute, I want to talk about a reference point, and someone goes, aha, I see your reference point, that's just a man-made fictional thing, and it's no more valid than somebody else's. And so we just are sort of free-floating for the most part, and that's where we are. In the contemporary world, we have a capacity to question everything, but very little ability to affirm anything beyond our own personal whims and possessive interest. That's what we see. We can question and strip everything down, but now how do you talk about something? And, you know, and it gets ridiculous at some point, and, you know, like the professor writes on the board, words have no meaning, and then you point out, well, the only reason that has meaning is because words have meanings, because, I've seen a few people you've done a really good job of debating people like that, and the person gets done explaining why everything's meaningless, and the person says, oh, you're being ironic. Well, no, I'm not being ironic, I'm being serious. And, you know, they're trying to show that this person's critique of everything they're doing falls on their own plate. And lots of times people aren't able to do that. So if I write, words have no meaning, you know, a grammatical structure in English of words, you see the helping verb, and you see, you know, you understand that. If words have no meaning, you know, I just throw whatever up. Glop, 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 glop. Like, what does that mean? Well, to me, today it means this. So there's a silliness to that, but it has sort of invaded into a larger world, which we'll take a look at. Pete. Yeah. And that is the hope that there are hopefully points of contact, there are bridges to be able to connect with people. And because we're going to see as they go forward, you know, this tip the hat early, nobody can live in nihilism. Rare is the person who can stay there. It's unlivable. And so there is a point where people are able to communicate and talk about things because there's no other way to live life. And so as people saying, then you are able to bring dialogue in, particularly if you are able to reflect upon your own tradition and to be able to take away some of the layers that are there that are problematic, that are inherited. As he has said most time, the most powerful parts of the culture are when we don't think it exists, when we're not, when it's not self-evident. And so, as just an example, if you were in the South during the time pre-Civil War, the culture that you were around would have just assumed that Negroes were an inferior species. That was just common. And to be able to, someone to be able to go and say, you know what, I, according to Scripture, I want to actually challenge your belief about that, about the nature of who God is and who he has made in the peoples around us. And so that was part of that exchange that it took a long time to get to. But that's where you can be able to look back and go, wait a minute, I have some inherited biases against people that really are for my advantage. It's advantageous for me to look down upon you as I make you do things I want you to do for me without paying you. And to be able to say, well, come on, let's just call it what it is. That's difficult. But that's also where the prophetic voice of the church and the Scripture needs to address those things to be able to say, we have done this wrong. And that's the difficulty we find ourselves in, because as this dissolution is all around us, there really is a lack of confidence of anything that's real about what is true. It's created, and we feel this, a place of absence. Is nothing good? Is nothing real? Is nothing true? That is a hallmark of sort of our life today, is a place of absence. And in the social world, the only thing left to connect the word and world is a will to power. This is sort of the Nietzschean point. And one of the things that we have, think sacraments, the covenant between the thing signified and the signifier, the world and the word, we have that. We have an actual means of connecting those things sacramentally. And the church has spoken about those things for millennia. And you see that in Scripture. But because of the brokenness of that, even when we talk about the Lord's Supper, particularly in the Protestant end of life or baptism, we get kind of weirded out by it, because we live in a culture that has struggled to maintain signifier and signified, word and world, bring them together. And so what gets replaced is a will to power, meaning he who has the biggest stick determines what the words mean for the moment. And that's even something that has changed. You start to see, you saw it in the political, or in the philosophical world, not Peter Berger, the Princeton guy was just kind of a nut singer, in others that started actually saying, well, while I find Nazi Germany reprehensible, I can't actually say that they were morally wrong. It was what their society decided for their time. And so genocide, by many people, is seen as, what a shame. Once you kill off whoever's left, you know, those people, and whoever's left will now go ahead and trade with you. While first we're going to, you know, we'll do sanctions and wag a finger at you and go, but we recognize that this is expedient for life because you guys can't get along. We don't have a solution for it. So the best solution is one of you kill off the other person. And no one's quite that crass, other than some philosophers. That philosopher has now got down into, and sometimes we go, that's the only solution possible, the will to power. And so when you're looking at causes of this, which we've talked about, there's been an intellectual pursuit of certainty that has resulted in skepticism that questions everything, that suspects everything, that distrusts everything, that disbelieves everything. Kind of enlightenment going forward. And people, examples of that, certainly Marx and Freud are a part of that, and others. And in literature, if you're an English major, where you've seen that is there's a rejection of the finality of the text and the authority of the author. So some of the most wackadoo stuff you read actually comes from English departments. They're the ones who have taken on, at least in the late 90s, early 2000s, have taken on postmodernism in its worst form. And you could write absolute trash papers that had this nonsensical, and people be, oh, this is brilliant, you know, it's kind of the emperor's new clothes. Because the text doesn't mean anything, and your authorial intent doesn't mean anything. It's all about what I see out of the text. So if I want to see Moby Dick as the oppression of the black person in Harlem, you know, and that's what it is. and people went to those kind of lengths. And again, in the department of literature is where it was seen in its worst way. The hard sciences, not so much in radical postmodernism, but more in the humanities. And this skepticism presented a real formal challenge to all the core ideas of the liberal arts program, of objects of inquiry. So the greatness of liberal arts got turned upside down on its head because of this entire deconstructive way of looking at it. Now, this one qualifier, it is unfair to make all skepticism negative because there are some myths that need debunked. The problem was it took a turn that offered very little in return. So there are things that need to be stripped away, kind of like taking off the layers of paint. But you got to restain it. You got to repaint it. It can't just leave it there. And that's not what's done. So again, it's very rare. Radical skepticism, you know, you only see a few grad students on college campuses where people who live that way. Very few are consistent relativists or committed postmoderns. It's just not livable. Dissolution at its extreme is highly toxic to life. And the average guy in the street, he's faced with these challenges, and it's not because he's reading French deconstructionist. It's because the social conditions, I mean, we talked about plausibility structures, the social conditions of our contemporary world are reinforcing a cultural logic that forms this break in trust. You're shaped by what you live in. And so this is just there, and people, again, they're not philosophy majors. They're not thinking about Foucault and Derrida. They're just living in a world that the social structures around them are highly influenced by this. And in pluralism, God, love, family, faith, loyalty, courage, beliefs mean different things now in different social contexts. So there's a gap between a speaker and what is spoken, between what is spoken and the words as they're understood as we hear them. Authority and truth are weakened. That's what we see. Beyond that, then, when we think of, okay, the electronic world we live in, that has contributed to this. When you think of electronic media, it has also transformed the nature of consciousness and culture. We all feel this. It has first compressed time and space. You can know what happened in Japan now. I'm like, boom, there. Time and space have been compressed. And it has also compartmentalized the world in incoherent ways. This is the one I don't think we understand how much this affects our brains. What does that mean? We can be watching, and this is an example from Hunter, we can be watching about a news story about a famine in Africa in a particular country, looking at this famine, and then it is followed up by an ad for erectile dysfunction. How do you put those things together? We just are so used to this that it doesn't seem to frame us, but that's weird. Fictional and real get slammed together all the time. The comical and the serious get combined. Insignificant and important are blended together all the time. That has an effect on us because it's incoherent. And third, it is also driven by commercial interest. So entertainment becomes the primary format for representing experience across the board. That means meaning has been trivialized, driven by audience positive responses. And the news is this way too. 24-hour news. You think of what's reported, how it's reported. It's patterned after a format of entertainment. So we can't tell the difference really between a reality show and news channels in some ways because it's the same format. And the fourth thing is it creates an illusion of intimacy with actors, politicians, strangers. It's a highly engineered reality. As one person said, off buttons don't really work because historical forces make it so difficult for us to resist. It's almost impossible. Grady's not here. It's funny. Maybe I'm saying something I shouldn't for him, but he got a cell phone. He has lived this far without a cell phone. But they got rid of their home phone, and what that has meant is his lovely wife often has been the messenger for people trying to get a hold of Grady. So you can imagine if you're constantly, call this person, call this person, call this person. It's like, here's your phone. I'm tired of being your secretary. So now he's entered. Okay, he's resisted. Great, he's 50. So he's done a great job of resisting the world. But even for him is inevitable. So he's here. I'd use an example. I am using an example. But think about how difficult it is to turn this off. And our consciousness is never independent of social reality in which it's embedded. And we have to know that. We are how we think, how our consciousness works, is a part of the embedded social reality. All of us. The electronic world has affected us all this way. It's been a, you know, the word is a paradigm game changer. Our words fail to have the same kind of traction they once did, and nor is there an environment that's really conducive to depth of reflection. We also know that. That's part of the thing. We don't get people talking about and thinking about and interacting very much. And I'll tell you, it's in the church just as much. You just look back at articles that are in Christianity Today now and jump back 20 years. 20 years ago, they were longer, more in depth. I tell you the same thing from sermonically speaking. It doesn't matter the length of the sermon, because people who even go a long time, the people who are really popular, they have adopted an entertainment stand-up comedian routine. And that's that give and take. Oh, he's so great to listen to, and it's engaging, and it's, well, very little information comes out of that because of the engaging style. It causes you to interact, but it also lowers content in order to do that, for by and large. And the ones who do it well, that's how they do it. And you look back, even sermons. We have 2,000 years of sermons written down, recorded. And our generation, for the most part, is pretty light fluff. That's just part of where we are. And Christian institutions can also perpetuate this by adopting this style in order to get, as I said, to be relevant. And it's new territory. So the challenge of difference and dissolution, they're not new. They're long-standing fixtures in our modern world. As I said, culture is most powerful when it is perceived as self-evident. So the problem is not with, you know, our freedom. It's rather with the autonomy of not willing to submit to any higher value. There's no submission to any authority higher than the self. And it fosters then a culture of banality, self-indulgence, acquisition, and empty spectacle. So that's just describing, and Hunter, I think, has done a pretty good job of describing, this is the world in which we live. All of us are there. Yes, sir. Yeah. Sure. And that's, when we talk about the bridge coming in, and so we don't end on this, oh, this is a negative, oh man, our life sucks because we're just this slew of horrible things around us. We have been given the very antidote for what is ailing the world around us. And we have to step forth. One is an understanding of how best to communicate, but it also is we do have the Word made flesh. We do have the one where Word and world come together, sign and signifier come together. And we were created to be, I love the word, a sacramental cipher between God and the world. We're meant to be, the world around us, we were meant to be able to communicate thanksgiving to God for what he has done and back and forth through us. That we are the connective point between God and the world. A kingdom of priests. And that has been broken. The word that we have, and it restores and it brings back. And so the challenge is all these things are there. We now have to think, how do we engage ourselves now in a society where it's hard to be faithful as Christians? It's hard not to give in. It's hard to be here. So we recognize that. But now, and this is part of why we're spending this time here, I'm not quite sure where we're going to go with this, but I'm hoping even in the fall, you know, after this, to be looking at what are things that the last thing I want to do is just have an informative Sunday school class about culture. I really, I mean, it's been fun. I mean, in that sense, like, this has been very helpful for me. But I don't want this to stop here. I don't want it to go like, oh, yeah, and now it's and then business as usual. We have to be able to take new insight and to be able to now live differently and help one another in the challenges that are out there. And we're just going to have to start small in our local setting. And, you know, other people are doing other things, and hopefully we can integrate some of those things. But it's a part of what we have to do. Belinda, I saw a hand. We'll have to end on this. Yeah. And that's what's before us. So in some ways, because probably in the kind of conservative Christian world, we tend to fall probably more on the right side of the political spectrum than we tend to fall on the left side. Not exclusively, but tend to. So in some ways, we have to hear that critique harder and to understand it then for where we're at. And we also have to understand, okay, what do we do with ourselves and how we engage given the circumstances we find ourselves? We have to actually do something. And the solution is not to create a bunch of elitists who are the Green Berets, the Marines of the Christian world who, you know, us 10 people are going to do all this, and if you aren't in, you're out. That doesn't work. It just creates a little utopia that fails and just usually ends being unloving and charitable in its own wackadoo culture. How do you live in the culture that God has placed you and be salt and light? So I got to pray because we got people coming in, and we'll... Father, help us to be salt and light. It's really hard to know how to do that well in our day and age. But God, we really, really need to. So please help. Amen.